Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Lying south of Bega in New South Wales, Australia, is the tiny hamlet of Callaroo. In 1997, it only had around 400 residents, living amongst the green pastures of prime South Coast dairy country. It was a tight-knit community where everybody knew their neighbour. There are no fancy houses, hotels or restaurants, just modest homes and a service station and a caravan park. Surrounded by bushland and beaches, the area was extremely popular for horseback riding and swimming. The tranquil and rural lifestyle provides locals with a sense of security, but in 1997, this sense of security was completely shattered when two local teenagers vanished while walking to a party. And as it turned out, the innocent act of being in the wrong place at the wrong time had deadly consequences. Lauren Barry and 16-year-old Nicole Collins were best friends and students at Bega High School. They had bonded over their shared love for horse riding and bushwalking. Lauren was soft-spoken, but she was also extremely outgoing and full of life. She wanted to work with small children or animals. Her father, Garrett Barry, was Bega Valley Shire Council town planner, and her mother, Cheryl, was a stay-at-home mum. Her brother Nathan was one of her best friends.
My sister, when we grew up, a lot of the properties that we lived on, there wasn't too many kids nearby most of the time, so she was my best mate as well as my sister. You know, just like any sister, brother and sister, we fought like cat and dog. We'd finish fighting and having an argument, and then there'd be this deep, unconditional love for each other.
My sister, she was in a really tight-knit group of friends. They were into the horses and horse riding and tried to avoid me and my mates as much as possible, harassing them, as young boys do. She was my best friend, and she was very strong. She had to be, because I was always picking on her and blaming her for everything.
Nicole, too, was a social butterfly who loved people. She worked part-time as a checkout in Coles supermarket in Bega, where she was known as a hard-working and dedicated employee. She had aspirations of becoming an interior designer or a chiropractor. Her father, Graham, was a vet, and her mother, Delma, was a nurse in the local day surgery. Among Lauren and Nicole's circle of friends were Sarah Brennan and Rebecca Kemble.
We always had fun things to do. Both Nicole and I and Rebecca all had horses, so we spent most of our weekends riding together.
Nicole, she was very outgoing, very friendly, engaging, not at all shy.
She was very vivacious. She always had lots of energy. So if you're ever feeling down in the dumps or not in a mood to maybe go for a ride or go and see some friends, she's always had the ability to make you feel more happy and energised to go and do it kind of thing.
She was just full of life and full of energy, and she was always doing things, always on the go. Lauren she was much more low-key.
Lauren was very much a homebody. She loved being at home with mum and dad and her brother.
She was calm and very sweet and kind and generous, and she was a lot of fun.
I was in year seven, and I'd just come from a school where I was actually bullied. So I was very vulnerable and didn't have any friends, didn't know anybody. And I was just sitting at school, you know, by myself, and Nicole came up to me and said, "I love your shirt." I was like, "Oh, okay, thank you." And from that moment on, just instantly like that, we were friends.
Lauren was much more shy. She was a lot like me. We were both introverts. We bonded and
I don't think I've ever had a friend like her that we just understood each other at some level. You know, it was just a connection that we had, and everything that we did was funny. You know, we were hilarious, we cracked each other up, and, you know, she was such a great girl.
The best friends had planned a camping party at White Rock in Kallaroo. White Rock was in the Evans Hill area, an area that both girls knew very well. It was only 1 or 2 kilometres away from their homes. Lauren was a champion long-distance runner and had run numerous bush tracks in the area. The camping party was to celebrate Lauren's upcoming 15th birthday, and the girls invited a number of other local boys and girls, as well as Nathan, Lauren's brother. After setting up camp on the 3rd of October 1997, the group relaxed around the campfire, swam and rode horses. Throughout the camping trip, the girls returned home to get showers and fresh clothing. On Saturday, Nicole returned home briefly to wish her mother a happy birthday. Meanwhile, Lauren attended a family dinner at her home. Afterwards, both girls returned to the campsite, and on Sunday morning, Nicole's parents visited the campsite to see how the kids were getting on. Her parents said that all of the teenagers were in high spirits and chatted away to them before they returned home. Kids had often camped at White Rock, and there had never been any problems. As they believed, it was a safe area. At approximately 9 p.m. on Sunday the 5th of October, the girls left their other friends at the campsite, stating that they were going to a party 7 kilometres away at Jellit Jellit. Earlier on that evening, two boys who were at the camp headed off to the party, and later on, Lauren and Nicole decided they wanted to go too. Nicole believed that her ex-boyfriend would be at the party and she wanted to chat with him.
Sarah and I both had our boyfriends there, and they didn't, and they were feeling quite excluded, I think. They were talking about wanting to leave and go to our friend Michael's place, because that's where Nicole's ex-boyfriend was. So Nathan had come out to visit us that day. He'd driven out. He was older. He had his own car. He had a license. And then he was leaving. And as he was getting into the car, I thought, quick, get up now. Tell him that girls want to go with him. If you don't, you're going to regret it. But I was like, my logic brain ruled that out. Like, that's stupid. What are you going to regret? Like, what's the worst thing that can happen? The urge was so strong in me to get up and tell him, wait, stop, the girls are going with you. A few hours later, it was dark and the girls decided that they really did want to go to the party and they were going to walk there. They had a torch, they had a bottle of Coke with some Jim Beam in it because we were classy. And they set off walking. I never thought that they would ever actually get there because it's a really long walk. So I thought they'll probably get to Nicole's house, which was the closest house, and go, too hard, and just sleep there.
So the last thing that I said to the girls before they left the campsite was, where are you going? Which Nicole said, I'm going to fix up my life, which obviously now, looking back, is ironic because she never got the chance.
The girls were experienced in the bush and they had gone on numerous horseback rides along the trails. They were carrying only a flashlight and no supplies or clothing, indicating that they had planned on returning to the campsite. However, the girls never returned to the campsite and they never showed up at the party. The alarm was raised the following morning when Nathan woke up and found that his sister and Nicole still weren't back. Nathan rushed back home to see if maybe the girls had stayed overnight at the family's home.
My parents asked me where Lauren was, and I said, isn't she here? Hasn't she come home? They headed this way in the evening. It was just over a kilometre from the campground. So I assumed that she would be there. So at that point, it was like, okay, she's not here. Something's not right, I guess. Maybe she's at Nicole's place. So I think my parents would have rung Nicole's parents to find out if the girls were there, and obviously they weren't.
I remember her parents arriving in the car and asking us, you know, through the window, have you seen the girls? To which we replied no. They then said the girls are missing. So we immediately, you know, assumed, oh, they're just at somebody's house. You know, we'll have to go and check everyone's house. To which we were told that that had already happened, and they'd called up a few different places and a few friends, and they were nowhere.
We assumed that they might have gotten lost walking home, but when you assume something like that, knowing them so well, it was just a hope that that's all it was.
Before I knew it, basically, there was police, SES, VRA, everyone was up at our campsite within such a short amount of time.
We began searching all the coastline, all the bush, all the common places that the girls would hang out or go to, popular, you know, places that they may have been, and to no prevail.
When the girls were nowhere to be found, their families alerted police and a search party was assembled. The officers were assisted by sniffer dogs and SES volunteers. The search party scoured the bushland near Tathara, looking for more clues which could hopefully lead to the pair of girls. The police air wing Polair also hovered overhead, but they were unsuccessful in finding any more clues. On day two of the search, it was called off due to heavy rainfall and poor visibility, but it continued at 7 a.m. on the third day. Initially, police announced that they didn't speculate foul play in the teenagers' disappearance. Quote, "At the moment, there's nothing to indicate that there's a major problem," end quote, said Constable Trish Swilkes of Bega Police.
At this stage, we've got two avenues of inquiry. One is that the two girls have left the area voluntarily, and secondly, that they've been forcibly taken from the area.
Due to the fact that Lauren and Nicole were teenagers, many questioned whether they had quite simply just ran away from home. One rumour that circulated around the area was that they had run off to join a hippie commune near Bega, or had run off to Melbourne. Lauren's father, Garrett, denounced this theory, stating that his daughter would never dream of running away. Quote, "There is just no reason to believe she or Nicole would do that. She is such a happy, outgoing girl, very considerate. She always phoned us to tell us where she was, even if she was just down the road," end quote. Nicole's father echoed this belief and said that he was also certain that his daughter would never get into the car with somebody that she didn't know. This theory was something that Detective Mark Winterflood and Detective Shane Box didn't believe either.
When you met their parents and sort of talked through the type of children they were, they would maintain constant contact, almost for no reason, in the middle of parties.
The families were adamant that their girls hadn't run away, that's not in their makeup, they've never done it before.
In the immediate aftermath of the disappearance, there were a number of reported sightings of the girls, some as far as Sydney and right down to Melbourne. However, they all led to dead ends. Quote, "We have received and checked out quite a few sightings, but most of them have been reported simply because people have seen two girls about their ages," end quote, said a police spokesman. They also announced that they were confident that the two girls weren't lost or injured in the bush somewhere. It wouldn't be long until worry turned to fear when a local man named Alan Lane discovered a jumper and flannel shirt while on his way to the local tip. It was located around 1 kilometre away from the camping ground and in the opposite direction of where the girls had supposedly been heading. The items of clothing were identified as belonging to Lauren and Nicole. The discovery led to fears that Lauren and Nicole had met foul play, but police said that they would be keeping an open mind.
I briefed my senior officers in Wollongong at Region and at Batemans Bay and just said, listen, there's more to it than this. Something's not right here. And as a result, the task force investigation commenced and we went from there.
One witness did come forward to say that they had spotted the two girls walking along the Snowy Mountains Highway, while another witness said they were certain that they had seen Lauren and Nicole talking to someone in a cream-coloured four-cylinder sedan at around 9:30 p.m. After these reported sightings, police soon declared that they believed that the girls may have hitchhiked or were taken and began actively looking for the car. Lauren and Nicole's parents made emotional pleas on national television, urging anybody with any information to come forward. Nicole's father, Graham, shared his belief that his daughter and best friend had been abducted. Quote, "It's a parent's nightmare to think that they're not going to see their children again. It's been obviously a worry all along that somehow or another they've been forcibly removed from the area. If they have, we'd just like any information at all," end quote. They even addressed the girl's potential captor, urging him to have some human decency and let them know if their daughters are alive or dead.
They're enduring almost unbelievable suffering. Two sets of parents tortured by the disappearance of their teenage daughters, pleading for help.
The pain I'm going through and not knowing where she is unbelievable.
Having fun, and she just said, "See you tomorrow." At 10:30, we were going to pick him up. She wasn't.
Both families were extremely proactive in the search. Nathan spent hours searching the rugged bushland near where the girls were last spotted. Quote, "I feel she's around here somewhere. It's where some of her clothes were found. I've hardly slept since Sunday, just a nap here and there," end quote, said Nathan.
The first thing I did was to try and drive to all the places where I thought the girls could have been. Houses, hangouts, places in the bush where we used to all go. Cubby houses and our favourite spots. And the girls weren't any of them, so then started driving the highways. And be looking out for anything along the side of the road, north, south, east, west.
The shock of the girls' disappearance reverberated through the idyllic Bega Valley surrounding Kallaroo. Locals assisted in the search and handed out flyers of the missing girls. Classmates of the missing girls returned to school from their holidays in a somber mood. Many had spent sleepless nights out searching for Lauren and Nicole. Bega High School formulated a strategy to cope with the outpouring of grief from the students and friends of the girls. Counselors were called in and quiet rooms were set aside for those who needed a moment to themselves. As the search for Lauren and Nicole entered its second week, the police were no closer to explaining the strange disappearance as they were on day one. By this point in the investigation, police were stopping cars along the Snowy Mountain Highway and questioning the drivers. Another driver told police he had seen the girls walking along the Tathara Road around 25 minutes after they left the campsite. He told police that the girls were alone. Police also decided that they would re-interview the friends and family of the girls, but they offered no further insight as to where they could be. The hope of finding the girls alive was quickly fading with every day that passed. The possibility that they had been abducted continually gained momentum. Police had a theory that they had been abducted after they walked through the bush and came upon the busy Snowy Mountain Highway where they were last seen. They still wanted to speak to the driver of the cream-coloured sedan, but as of yet, nobody had come forward. Police next focused their investigation to the Tathara area after they received a tip that the girls had been spotted in the area at around 11:15 p.m. on the night they vanished. Police went door to door asking locals if they had seen or heard anything suspicious that night. One local said that at around 11:45 p.m., they heard a vehicle racing towards the beach and heard screams from two women. The screams did not bode well for the two missing girls, and police issued a statement which said, quote, "Police wish to speak to anyone who might have witnessed or heard these events, or if the events are not connected, the two women in the car at the time. If these two women could come forward and speak to task force members, they could be eliminated from the inquiry," end quote. Of course, the news was devastating to Lauren and Nicole's family. They had been on a roller coaster of emotions, and this new update made their hope that they would see their girls alive again almost completely dissolve into nothing. Graham spoke to the media, quote, "We felt like they were abducted. Well, I did anyway, from within the first hour of them being reported missing. It's just not like them to wander away, and even after a quick search here and there for something that might have been usual, they weren't there. When we found out from the other kids what their intentions were, I thought they've walked out on the road and I bet they've got into a car," end quote. Graham relayed the belief that the screams from inside the speeding car came from Lauren and Nicole. He said that both families were completely drained from the ordeal and that he was finding it difficult to shake the feeling of defeat each night. There was little traction in the case until the 12th of November 1997, when police announced that they had arrested and were questioning two men in relation to the disappearance.
And it was just information from the police that, yes, that you should look at these two blokes. They're into the badness, they're into sexual assaults, and they may fit the criteria.
police placed the families on notice and said that a breakthrough in the case was imminent, but did not elaborate any further. The man had been arrested after an informant called police and said that the man had been speaking suspiciously about the case and that they were in Bega at around the time the girls disappeared. When police brought them in for questioning, they also found evidence in a car which had been stolen by the two men. Initially, they were tight-lipped about what had been found in the car, but later disclosed that they had found blood-stained clothing.
In the vehicle that he was driving was some blood-stained clothing in the boot. Let's go and introduce ourselves. Let's have a look at this clothing. Who knows? It could be the girl's clothing or something we can identify.
In another development, AFP divers began searching a section of Lake Burley Griffin near Lennox Gardens. They announced that they were looking for a possible weapon. The girls' families, as well as the public, were left in the dark as police and the AFP refused to comment. Was the fact that they were looking for a weapon confirmation that Lauren and Nicole were dead? The following day, it was announced that the badly decomposed bodies of Lauren and Nicole had been discovered, lying beside the bank of Fiddler's Green Creek, near the Cann Valley Highway. There was absolutely no attempt made to conceal their bodies.
And do you agree that you walked, or we walked together through the bush and just across the creek and slightly upstream, we came to an area where there's a large tree fallen across the river.
Yeah.
And beneath the root section of that tree and a portion of water was what appeared to be the remains of a deceased person.
Yes. Right.
And are you able to tell me now if that was the remains of the girl with the dark hair?
Yes.
Police confirmed that they had both been sexually assaulted and then stabbed repeatedly. Quote, "They've been here for some 6 weeks and we still have some difficulties determining what happened," end quote, said Victorian Homicide Squad Head Chief Inspector Rod Collins. He also disclosed that they had reason to believe that Lauren and Nicole had been there since the day that they disappeared and that they had been murdered where they were found. Quote, "They have been taken down a very steep incline across the creek and we believe that's where they lost their lives," end quote, said Collins. Detective Shane Box, who had become very close with both families during the investigation, had the horrible task of sharing the crushing news.
It's probably the most difficult task a police officer could do would be to look at families of two young girls in the eyes and tell them that their girls were murdered and that was the last they would ever see of them. And it was also especially hard for me as a father of two girls to be able to do that particular task.
The discovery of the bodies ended the agonising 6 week search for the two girls and shattered the innocence of their quaint town.
I was 17 years old when I found out, and yeah, it rocked my world. It just destroyed every little bit of security or love and knowledge I knew of the world had just been shattered. I didn't know that this sort of stuff could happen, or that there were people in the world that could do this sort of harm to others.
Graham admitted that he and his wife Delma had been expecting the worst, but said that the details about what his daughter and her best friend had suffered was way worse than he possibly could have imagined. He had asked to see his daughter's body so that he could, quote, "share her pain," end quote, but his request was turned down. Inspector Shane Box said that he had been protecting Graham by not allowing him to see his daughter's body. Instead, the families visited the site where their girls were killed. The names of the two men were not initially released to the public, but police did confirm that they had led police to the bodies and that they had found the murder weapon in Lake Burley. One of the two men was on bail after his trial on child sexual assault charges were aborted. He had been facing 10 charges of sexually assaulting a 12-year-old girl, but the charges were aborted because of what the judge said were extraordinarily prejudicial comments by the New South Wales Minister for Police, Mr. Paul Whelan. 3 weeks later, Lauren and Nicole were abducted. The news led to many questions as to why such an offender wasn't under close surveillance. The two men were finally identified as Leslie Camilleri and Lindsay Beckett. Leslie Camilleri was born in Liverpool in May of 1969. By 1981, he was a familiar face in Minda Children's Court after charges of breaking and entering and stealing. Over the next 5 years, he was a regular in the juvenile justice system for charges of theft, car offences, carrying a weapon, possession and absconding. It was around 1988 when he headed towards Queensland, and in 1989 he was in trouble with the law once again. He was charged with 15 counts of unlawful use of a car, 8 counts of breaking and entering, and 92 counts of stealing. When he broke into a home, Camilleri would literally steal anything, from TV sets and stereos to ice lollies and dog leads. In April of 1997, Camilleri was charged with possessing stolen goods. In October of 1995, he had been charged on 10 counts, including 6 of sexual intercourse with a child and 1 of indecent assault, committed against an 11-year-old girl. He went to trial in September of 1997, but as mentioned earlier, the trial was aborted after the judge ruled comments from a police officer as extremely prejudicial. Lindsay Beckett was born in one of the poorest parts of New Zealand. He was the product of rape and was born when his mother was just 15 years old. He never knew his father, but was abused by his stepfather, who was an angry drunk. By age 13, Beckett was drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana. As a teenager, he abandoned his family and fled to Australia, where he drifted through southern New South Wales, living a life of crime. He funded his lifestyle by breaking into cars and assaulting and robbing people. Then he met a young mother named Laura Lee Tatt at Griffith Hospital, where she was recovering after an assault. The two moved in together, and over the course of 6 years, Beckett routinely beat and raped Tatt, who bore him 3 children. While Beckett was a career criminal, he was certainly no criminal mastermind. He didn't hide his tracks or attempt to conceal evidence and was pretty easy to catch. In April of 1997, Beckett was suspended from driving after a high-range drink driving offence. The following month, he was fined $100 for offensive conduct, and the following week, charged over marijuana found in his car. Then in June, he was committed to trial on charges of sexual assault, but was given bail. With both men on bail, they headed towards Canberra. In the wake of the murders, many questioned how Camilleri and Beckett had been allowed by the justice criminal system to roam through New South Wales without fear of being locked up. Both men had well over 200 criminal convictions between them both. The tragic tale lurking beneath the murders was that both men really should have been locked up at the time of the murders. Beckett, especially, should never have been released on bail. As it turned out, in the run-up to the murders, Beckett was ordered to meet with a parole officer but never showed up. Nevertheless, there were no repercussions and nobody thought to rearrest him. Beckett had a litany of court cases ranging from sexual assault to drug charges and driving with an unlicensed vehicle. The majority of the crimes were committed while Beckett was out on bail, yet each time he was able to avoid incarceration. These two men had repeatedly waltzed through the criminal justice system, and now two innocent teenagers were paying the price with their lives. As a timeline of the murders was being determined, a memorial service was held for Lauren and Nicole in Bega. Around 90% of local businesses closed to allow employees to commemorate the lives of the two girls. The open-air service was held in Littleton Gardens and was conducted by Salvation Army Chaplain Captain Rob Anderson. More than 3,000 people crammed into the gardens to attend the memorial. Those who spoke at the service described Lauren as a talented athlete with a smile to die for, and Nicole being always boisterous and the centre of attention. The girls' fathers, Graham and Garrett, thanked the community for its constant support since the girls disappeared. On the 16th of November, Beckett reenacted the sequence of events that ended with the murders of Nicole and Lauren. The route took Beckett to sites in Canberra on the far south coast and across the Victorian border to eastern Gippsland.
Liz was driving the car and we went to the beach because I hadn't been to the beach for ages and we were going to go there for a drink.
Yeah.
and just see if there's any parties. And we were going up the hill and seeing these two girls there, and Les stopped and asked them if they wanted a lift. And they said, oh yeah, all right. And then we said we're going to the beach and asked them if they wanted to come. And they said, yeah.
The night of terror began when Camilleri and Beckett picked Lauren and Nicole up in a white Ford sedan outside Callaroo at around 10 p.m. The men pulled up alongside the girls and told them that they were going to the beach for some beers and invited them along. Tragically, Lauren and Nicole agreed. They did indeed go to the beach for a while, but as they were driving back to the campsite, the car began scraping on the surface of the dirt track.
And he freaked out. And he was saying, what the fuck are you doing? What are you fucking doing? And he was just freaked right out. So he was going, pointing his head to stop them from hopping out.
In terms of your relationship with these girls at that time, can you describe that to me? Well, are they under some duress? Are they happy? Are they friendly?
They're under some duress.
Shut up!
Right. Explain that to me.
They knew, well, Les put a hard word on them, so if they stop up, he'll kill them.
According to Beckett, Camilleri went into hysterics and started shouting at the girls. He pulled over to the side of the road and produced a knife and threatened the girls to comply to what they demanded of them.
They were going along there. Yes, do you mind if we have sex with you? And they said no. And so then we kept going. Kept driving.
They first of all drove to Wallagoot Road in Callaroo, where Camilleri raped Nicole while Beckett raped Lauren. They then headed to Ben Boyd National Park, where both men raped both girls, and then again in Eden, where Beckett had once worked on a fishing trawler.
And they were travelling down there, and as a result of Camilleri's want to rape one of the other girls, use the term swap girls, they pulled into the side of a road at the Ben Boyd National Park, just north of Eden, where again both girls were raped by each offender. They went down to the wharf and had a look to see whether the boat that he once worked on was there. During the driving through Eden itself, the girls were told to keep their heads down, and as a result, after not finding the boat and Beckett's supposed knowledge of the area, they attempted to try and find a back road out of Eden.
They drove around for around 8 hours, periodically stopping to rape the girls and physically assault them. At one point during the night, Camilleri left the car with Lauren, leaving Beckett and Nicole alone in the car.
Camilleri left the vehicle with Lauren Barry and raped her in some bushes. After that rape, it was expressed between Beckett and Camilleri that they used the words, can't go back. And that was expressed by Camilleri, and Beckett understood that realistically that the girls would not be able to be released.
Seemingly aware of their fate, the girls began to question their captors if they were going to be killed and began begging for their lives. The two men denied that they were going to kill them and said that they were just going to tie them up so that they could make a getaway. According to Beckett, Camilleri then instructed him to find a secluded area off the road. The girls were then gagged and led around 250 metres down a steep embankment to Fiddler's Green Creek.
And then we tied the girls up, tied their hands up, stings around their mouth so they wouldn't yell.
What sort of things?
Just to stop them from yelling, just some of their jeans. He told me to tie her up at the bank. And then I tied her up to a tree. and Les told me what to do.
Here, the man ordered the girls to get into the cold creek and wash away any evidence. Next, they hogtied Lauren beside the creek and tied Nicole to a tree, around 30 metres away from Lauren. Once rendered unable to move, Camilleri returned to the car, telling Beckett to, quote, do his thing, end quote.
Yeah, he said drag her over to the water and drown her. And the other one, she was jumping around. So I tried to stab her.
Beckett first of all attempted to drown Lauren in the creek by holding her head underwater. However, while flailing in the creek, Lauren splashed water on Beckett. Infuriated that his jeans were wet, Beckett then produced a knife and stabbed Lauren in the neck, cutting his own thumb in the process. With Lauren dead, Beckett turned his attention to Nicole. The forest was eerily quiet. There was absolutely no doubt that Nicole had heard her best friend struggle for her life, and when that finally stopped, she almost certainly knew that Lauren was dead and that she too was going to die.
He stabbed her in the neck and she started to sort of flail about and wasn't dying, so he then stabbed her in the Adam's apple and the knife gets stuck and he can't get it out.
Okay, and how did you kill her?
I had to cut her throat.
He eventually gets it out and he stabbed her in the heart and that failed also, and he even describes kicking her, trying to get her to die, and so he eventually dies.
I cut her throat first.
Mm.
And then she stabbed her.
Okay.
When Beckett approached Nicole, she said, quote, you're going to kill me, aren't you, end quote. Beckett ordered Nicole to shut up before cutting her throat and stabbing her twice in the chest while aiming for her heart. Despite her fatal injuries, Nicole was still alive. Beckett mercilessly punched and kicked her until she stopped moving.
No one chooses how to die, but their deaths were just horrific in every respect. Not only do they have to see Lauren dying, she has to, you know, it's just a terrible death.
Following the murders, the men drove to Canberra, where they burnt Beckett's blood-stained clothing and the ropes that they had used to tie the girls up.
In relation to the blood that was on your clothing, can you just show me where the blood was on your clothing, approximately?
It was on my sleeves, me pants, there's bits of it on my face, on my football jumper.
The following year, Beckett pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder. In a pre-sentencing hearing, it was revealed that Camilleri and Beckett had abducted and raped an unnamed 19-year-old woman 3 weeks before the murders of Nicole and Lauren. The woman was held for 12 hours, but managed to escape and hide in a wombat hole before running to get help. Camilleri had yet to enter a plea, but it was announced that Beckett had turned Crown witness and would give evidence at the committal hearing of Camilleri. Beckett's defence lawyer, Mr. Patrick Tehan, said that the Justice Frank Vincent should take into consideration Beckett's youth, his guilty plea, and his promise to give evidence against Camilleri when it came to sentencing him. He said that Beckett was abused by his stepfather and was the father of 3 young children, so could appreciate the grief felt by the girls' families. Justice Vincent described the evidence as some of the most horrible he had ever seen, quote, in an extensive exposure to violence, which now almost encompasses 40 years, I do not think that I have ever heard a more terrible or moving description of a death of a person, end quote. He sentenced Beckett to 2 consecutive life terms, with a 35-year minimum. It was one of the longest non-parole periods in Australian history. The details of the crime were so horrendous that Justice Vincent was on the verge of tears as he delivered his 27-page summary. Quote, you took your knife out and stabbed Lauren Barry because, to use your own words, you were pissed off when your knee became wet as you attempted to drown her. Your description of the death of Nicole Collins was one of the most chilling I have ever encountered over many years, in that it was totally devoid of any recognition that you were speaking about the killing of an innocent girl, end quote. The following week after his sentencing, Beckett was back in court, but this time he was testifying against Camilleri in a pre-trial hearing. Camilleri pleaded not guilty. A psychologist with the New South Wales Department of Corrective Services said that Camilleri had been suicidal and was afraid of jail. She said she believed that he was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. Nevertheless, Magistrate Wendy Wilmouth ordered Camilleri to stand trial. The trial of Camilleri opened in February of 1999. In opening statements, Crown Prosecutor Graham Hicks told the courtroom that Camilleri had raped and murdered Lauren and Nicole. He said that Camilleri will ask them to believe that he was on heroin and asleep while Beckett raped and murdered the girls. Camilleri had told police that he awoke from his slumber in the car to see Beckett, quote, emerging from the deep forest covered in blood, end quote. Hicks walked the jury through the final terrifying hours of the girls' lives. The woman who had been raped by Camilleri and Beckett took to the stand to detail her traumatizing ordeal. She said that Camilleri had threatened her with a knife, telling her that he wouldn't hesitate to kill her. After taking turns in raping the young woman over the course of several hours, the men began discussing how they would kill her.
She was then sexually assaulted at knife point and taken along various dirt roads out of Canberra. And at one point, she was quite desperate and said, I need to go to the toilet, which was a bit of a ploy. And when they opened the door for her, she ran, and she ran and ran and ran to a wombat burrow where she hid herself. And they were searching through the bush with their knives trying to find her.
Her ordeal practically mirrored the ordeal of Lauren and Nicole, but unlike them, this unnamed woman managed to escape. Beckett also took the stand to describe how Camilleri ordered him to kill the two girls. Beckett testified that he told Camilleri that he didn't want to kill both of them himself, but Camilleri said that if he didn't kill both of them, that he would kill him. Hicks addressed Beckett, quote, your initial objection was not so much to killing a girl yourself, but just killing both of them. Is that right? End quote. Beckett replied, yes. Forensic scientist Maxwell Jones also testified at the trial. He told the jury that a semen sample found on the shirts of one of the victims matched Camilleri. He said that the chances that a member of the general Victorian population having the same combination of DNA type was expected to be rarer than one in a million.
Puts Camilleri not only at the scene but being involved in sexual activity of which he'd continued and during court continued to deny.
In April, after 48 hours of deliberation, Camilleri was found guilty of first degree murder. He was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. The verdict was a relief to both families.
When we heard he was guilty, I can remember my parents and Nicole's parents yelling, screaming yes and yelling for joy that he'd, which is hard to get some joy, but from all the stress and pressure we put through, it was a positive in a bad situation. It was a ray of light, I guess, that someone was going to be held responsible for the girl's murders.
Guilty. They were the best words I'd heard in this long trial.
Now maybe our girls can rest in peace, and we'd really like to thank the jury. They got it right.
The family spoke to the media outside court, with Graham stating, quote, we're just looking forward to putting all the ugly bits behind us and getting on and remembering our girls the way they were, end quote.
13-year-old Prue Bird disappeared 20 years ago. Today, Camilleri pleaded guilty to her murder. Prue's mother, Jenny, was in court.
Must have been a relief though to finally get a guilty.
Yes, that was good.
Jenny Bird last saw her daughter at their Melbourne home in February 1992. Just recently, she made a fresh appeal for information. Prue's body has never been found.
She was 13. Innocent little girl that someone has taken and murdered for nothing.
In 2012, Camilleri confessed to the murder of 13-year-old Prue Bird, who had disappeared from her Glenroy home in February of 1992. He was sentenced to an additional 28 years.
In my 37 years in the police force, this was probably the cruelest and most tragic murder I've had to deal with. Most of the detectives involved would have been on previous murder investigations, but what I think separated this one was that the intense cruelty of their final hours of the two girls, that they should suffer such horrific sexual experiences and then be killed so brutally. Most of us on the team had daughters. And so you empathise with parents as to how, I don't know how they could ever move on from it. I don't think you could possibly.
What I say to them, if I ever saw them again, is that I'm really sorry. And that's the hardest thing for me. It's the guilt. Living with the guilt. That we couldn't save them. That they were in that car for so long, waiting for someone to save them.
The small hamlet of Kallaroo was never really the same after the brutal murders of Lauren and Nicole. Their killers represented the darkness where local women and children now feared to walk. The murders left the tight-knit community with traumatic images of the fear, trauma and pain that Lauren and Nicole had experienced on that horrific night. To be a human is to understand pain and fear and to know that we all have an equal right to life. The case of the Bega schoolgirl murders highlighted the fact that some people in this world do not have that innate human understanding. As Camilleri and Beckett languish in prison, we know that they're finally exactly where they belong and where they should have been on that fateful evening that they crossed paths with Lauren Barry and Nicole Collins. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big massive thank you to our new Patreons, Courtney Waters, True Crime Nana, Katie Grass, Kyra, Finwee, and Kayla. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support really does go a long way in helping me cover the costs of hosting, producing, researching, and all that important stuff. If you're interested in ad-free episodes and early release episodes and articles, make sure you check out Morbidology on Patreon. I'd also like to thank everybody who has taken the time to leave a kind review on iTunes and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, guys, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
I'm Christine, and I'd like to introduce you to the True Crime Files podcast, a bi-weekly podcast that focuses on mysterious disappearances and unsolved murders. Every 2 weeks, we'll be releasing an episode that'll help you get to know a case really well without having to invest a lot of your time. Derived from the articles up on the True Crime Files website, you'll find that our show covers a diversity of victims and perspectives. You'll probably also notice that our episodes are narrated by Scott Fuller from the Frozen Truth and Status Pending podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to the True Crime Files today so that you never miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening, being a part of our true crime community, and helping to shine a light on cases that might otherwise be overlooked or underreported.
Calling all true crime fans, murderinos, crime junkies, and wine coven members. Have you listened to Murder in the Rain yet?
Murder in the Rain is a true crime podcast based in the Pacific Northwest, focused on the local cases that make us the notorious home of bizarre crimes and serial killers.
I'm your host, Alicia Holland.
And I'm your host, Emily Rowney.
I'm Josh. I forgot. I was...
In each episode, we will cover a case to bring you all the details of the crime. We often feature interviews with people close to the cases, including authors, victims, doctors, and detectives.
Most content is dark and not suitable for young or sensitive listeners, but we do try to lighten the mood by providing a blooper reel at the end of every single episode. Trust me, you'll love it.
Check us out today, and if you like us, don't forget to subscribe, follow us on social media, and leave us a review.
Our website, murderintherain.com, has additional content, podcast feeds, discount codes to some of our sponsors, and an interactive map with locations for each episode.